Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. Financial markets have been on a roller coaster ride in recent weeks, reacting to the latest moves in the U.S.-China trade war, fears of a global economic slowdown, and corporate earnings reports. Meanwhile, President Trump continues to call on the Fed to cut interest rates and has discussed the possibility of a payroll and capital gains tax cut. To break all of this down and to help us understand the impacts, two experts, economist Hugh Johnson and Siena College economics professor Aaron Pasitti, are in the studio for today's discussion and to answer your questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We talk money and Wall Street coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. In 5 days of trading last week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average had 4 days where it rose or fell by more than 300 points, with an 800-point drop thrown in. The stock market continues to react to the latest moves in the U.S.-China trade war, fears of global recession, and corporate earnings. To help us better understand all of this roller coaster, we welcome back Hugh Johnson and Aaron Pasitti. Hugh is the chief investment officer and founder of Hugh Johnson Advisors, LLC, in Albany. He is an economic advisor to the chairman of the New York State Assembly Committee on Ways and Means, a professor at Union Clarkson Graduate College, and a former member of the New York Stock Exchange. Aaron Pasitti is an associate professor of economics at Siena College, whose research and teaching focuses on macroeconomics, political economy, labor markets, employment insecurity, inequality, and economic history. In addition to academic journals, Aaron's research has been featured in The Washington Post, The Baltimore Sun, and The Huffington Post. He's also on that show we sometimes call the WAMC Roundtable. If you have a question about Wall Street, trade, the global economy, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551. Hugh, Aaron, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Thanks.
Let's start with something very basic. And we hear on the media, people talk about this at the water cooler. The word is recession. I would bet you dollars to donuts, 90% of the people who say the word recession have no idea what a recession is. So tell us, at 101 level, what is a recession?
Well, the classic definition of what our economy is doing, or the measure of our economy, is gross domestic product, or real gross domestic product. In other words, gross domestic product adjusted for inflation, which measures output for the U.S. economy. And if we have two successive quarters in a row where the growth rate of the U.S. economy is negative, then it's officially becomes or is qualifies as a recession. It's that simple.
Why is that a bad thing, Aaron Pasitti?
Because people lose jobs, firms produce less, people's standard of living falls. So it's a period where the economic pie is shrinking instead of growing. So there's less money, less jobs, less goods and services to go around.
And we talk about a bear market, and there are concerns that this market has reached peak and is now going to be sliding backwards. First, let's tackle that. Hugh Johnson, I read your August update, and I got to say, having understood about 12% of the whole thing, it's fascinating reading. You talk about the cases for and against a bear market and a recession, the inverted yield curve, which is another thing we'll talk about before we get to calls, a possible melt-up, whatever that is, and risks associated with the U.S. federal government deficits. So let's talk about, first, the bear market and the chances for that. You seem to have, in the short term, a little optimism.
Yeah, I would say I do have optimism, and I would say that's on the short term for sure. And when I say short term, I really mean between now and the end of the year. In other words, I think there's a little bit left in this so-called bull market. I think it's important just to start, just to simply recognize that this bull market or period of rising stock market prices has gone for 125 months, which makes it the longest bull market in history. So, you know, trees just simply don't grow to the sky, and therefore common sense alone says that maybe that we'll see the end of it. There are those out there that will say, no, it could go another 3 or 4 years, be even longer than the longest. I doubt that very seriously. So the question is, why do I see a little bit of why am I a little bit optimistic on the near term? And I would say because of the performance of the financial markets. When I take a look at what investors are doing, and investors tend to get it right, I see that they're buying the so-called bull market or economically sensitive sectors and the defensive sectors, at least until recently. But the defensive sectors, things that are really safe places to be in the stock market, they're avoiding, and that's investors are sending a fairly clear signal that they think there are positive things ahead for the economy and, most importantly, earnings. And the second thing is that those trends in the stock market, those positive trends or sort of bullish trends, are more or less confirmed by important monetary and economic variables. One of the ones that I pay a lot of attention to, it's got some flaws, but I pay a lot of attention to, is the index of leading economic indicators, which has been basically going up for a period of at least 24 months. We've had some days or months when it's been down, but nevertheless has been saying that the prospects for the economy remain positive. That's all near-term stuff. Believe me, that all could change, and that could change as soon as the evidence, the market performance could change and the economic variables could change and give an entirely different signal. If indeed we start to get those signals that say the recovery in the economy and earnings is going to end and it's going to be a recession.
Aaron, before you jump in here, how much of this up and down of the markets is psychology related? In other words, is there self-fulfilling prophecy? Investors are spooked and therefore markets go down. If investors are positive, things keep rolling. Is there some sort of psychosomatic action at work here?
Absolutely. It's some of it's based on economic fundamentals. So if you look at the main macro variables, like the unemployment rate, which has been under 4% for an extended period of time, the unemployment rate's the lowest it's been since the late 1960s. GDP growth is still healthy, although slowing. The fundamentals of the macroeconomy appear pretty sound, but you can talk yourself into a recession. And a famous economist once said, expansions don't die of old age, meaning it's not just because we've had the longest expansion in U.S. economic history that we're due for a recession. It's because there are forces at play, whether they're self-induced, trade policy, or whether it's the bursting of a housing bubble or a stock market bubble. Recessions begin and expansions end because of some event. You can talk yourself into one of those events. You know, if investors think that the Trump tariff policy is going to seriously crimp growth, the goal is to get out before everybody else does. And if you start to see market swings where, you know, large-scale investors are dumping stocks en masse, then everybody else says, well, they must know something I don't. So they dump stocks, and that's called a fire sale where prices go down. And the next thing you have is a self-induced decline in asset prices. Businesses might hold off hiring workers or, you know, more drastically start laying off workers. So, yeah, a lot of it can be self-induced.
So the big players in the markets, they all have some propagandists at work here?
I don't know if you what you mean by propagandists, but the big players in the market are certainly, as Aaron has said, pay very close attention to not only the performance of the markets, but they also pay very close attention to those sort of measures of what big investors and small investors think about current stock market conditions. And in that vein, maybe this isn't quite germane to what you're asking, is one of the things that has been missing, which gives me a little bit of reason to be optimistic over the near term, what's been missing is this widespread optimism or euphoria. It's been incredibly subdued. There's not a lot of optimism about prospects for stocks. Stock markets, bull markets end when there's a lot more optimism even on the point of euphoria. And we just have not seen that, which leads me to believe when I say melt up, the market could go higher and start to generate that level of optimism or euphoria.
In other words, big the optimism leads to bad things.
Yeah, because when everybody gets optimistic and they're all invested in the stock market, there's only one place to go. They become less optimistic and they start to sell some of their stocks, and that's what creates what might be, as Aaron is alluding to, a self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, a self-fulfilling in the sense that when stocks go down, people's expectations or their optimism goes down, they sell stocks.
And they might even start to
reduce their consumption or their spending.
Right.
So the performance of the stock market will have an impact on the underlying economy or consumer spending, and then it becomes a vicious downward cycle.
So it's important that, you know, the stock market's one indicator, and it's a convenient indicator, but it certainly moves a lot more rapidly and a lot more drastically than some of the more foundational economic variables. And what Hugh was saying was spot on, is that changes in stock prices only affect stock owners. The richest 1% of the population owns 50% of all stocks. The richest 10% of the population owns 90% of the stocks. And the richest 50% of the population owns 99% of the stocks. So changes in stock prices don't affect half of the population. But a lot of people see changes in the stock market and say, well, this must signify something. And that was actually an important explanation of why the stock market crash in 1929 turned into the Great Depression. Even though so few people owned stock in 1929, they saw the panic that was associated with it and started to reduce their consumption. Mm. And when they reduce their consumption, businesses don't see as many customers walking in the door, so they reduce hiring. They lay workers off, and then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and a vicious cycle downward.
Aaron Pasitti is here. Hugh Johnson is here. Our number is 800-348-2551, and we'll get to the calls in a moment. But first, when we come back from break, Aaron and Hugh are going to tell us what the heck is an inverted yield curve and why should we care? Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. We talk economy and we talk markets and we talk all sorts of things that most of us don't really delve too deeply into with Hugh Johnson and Aaron Pasitti. Our number is 800-348-2551. Quickly, before we jump on the phones, gentlemen, and I'll go to Aaron first. The inverted yield curve, it's been all over the news. People don't really know exactly what it is. You got the 30-year, you got the 10-year. What's going on?
Okay. So, yeah, this is something that, you know, economists and investors pay a lot of attention to. The easiest way to summarize this is that the rate of return you get on a bond, which is called its yield, tends to be higher for the longer term. So the longest dated U.S. Treasury bill, which is a bond, is 30 years.
Right.
A lot can happen between now and 30 years. So people who are buying their bonds ask for a higher return when they lend the government money.
Right.
However, shorter-term bonds tend to have lower yields because less can happen in that interim. So there's a lot of factors that affect bond yields. The risk investors see in what can happen during that time period is a big one. So normally, longer-dated bonds like the 30-year and the 10-year Treasury bill tend to have a higher yield than, you know, the six-month, the one-year, or the two-year Treasury bill. Over the past 45 years, when the yield on short-term treasuries rise above the long-term yield, it's a sign that investors perceive more risk in the short term than in the long term. And that's what's happening now, is that, you know, investors who are buying bonds see more of a risk to the U.S. economy in the next year or two than they see over the next 10 or 30 years. And the inversion of that yield curve when short-term bond rates rise above long-term bond rates has preceded every recession since the end of World War II.
Hugh.
Yeah, I couldn't beat that explanation. And if somebody's mystified, no offense, Aaron, by his explanation or any explanation I could give.
I can tell Ray was.
Well, it's easy.
Oh, you were talking?
It's easy to get mystified. So if the simply stated, if the yield on a 10-year treasury goes below the yield on a 91D T-bill, that's the way I would measure it, you're probably, the economy's in for trouble. You can get this information from the New York Federal Reserve. They post it every month. But the point being, and I think the most important point that Aaron's is mentioning, is that when the yield curve inverts, when the yield on a 10-year goes below the yield on a 2-year or a 91-day bill, that's almost invariably a signal that the economy, in the minds of investors, but the economy is headed for trouble. The yield curve has inverted 8 times since 1965, different time period. One time it gave a false signal, which was 1965, and the other 7 times it was perfect. It signaled that a recession was in the future. I think it's important to understand that the yield curve inverted in June, as I measure it, 10-year 90. And that signaled that a recession would start in the middle of 2020 or June of 2020. There are other ways of trying to time this thing. All of it's a little bit grandiose. But nevertheless, we're talking about a recession. It's signaling effectively investors through the yield curve and, quite frankly, sometimes through the stock market, are signaling mid-2020 for a recession.
Okay, before we go to Arthur and Pauling, and Arthur's been waiting a long time, let me follow up on this. You say in the minds of investors, and it would appear from what you gentlemen have just said, a lot of this has to do, again, with perception of investors. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying it's perception, but it's not perception. It's not whimsy. It's a perception based on something Aaron had said before, which is they're actually looking at hard data and coming to a conclusion, whether it shows up in the yield curve or it shows up in the decline in stock prices, which both are leading indicators of the economy. Regardless of where it shows up, it's in the minds of investors, but it's based on their assessment of underlying economic and earnings conditions. And in both cases, they're saying things are slipping.
Okay.
And when they say that, investors tend to get it right, Ray. And I think that's the important point.
Right.
Investors collectively tend to get it right.
But we have now, based on the prediction where the inversion happened in June, so based on the predictions, you and others would say July 2020 is when the recession hits,
June 2020. Somewhere.
My point is a lot of things can happen. In other words, there could be a favorable trade war resolution, a new deal, this and that. What happened in 1965 that stopped it?
The Federal Reserve was leaning towards less restraint very aggressively. There were a lot of international economic conditions which pulled us out of the potential recession. Incidentally, it was just postponed, in my view, until 1970. But nevertheless, we didn't get it when we were supposed to get it, so-called supposed to get it, which was 65 or 66. And could it be a false signal this time, which is really what you're getting at? And of course it could. Yeah, you bet. There's nothing foolhardy. And I think if there's anything that bothers me about this is that everybody's talking about the yield curve. And when everybody's talking about something being an infallible indicator, I've learned on Wall Street, watch out.
Yeah, bond markets don't come up in casual conversation very often.
No, not good ones anyway.
Bond markets, let alone the inverted yield curve. But like Hugh was saying, I want to point out, investors are looking at hard data. So to the extent that they're switching their investments from stocks, which are risky and volatile, to essentially a risk-free rate of return on U.S. government bonds, they're paying attention to leading indicators. And there's a host of leading indicators, but there have been 3 over the past few months that have started to turn downward. And that is hours worked, manufacturing activity, and consumer confidence surveys. So all of those are saying that, you know, businesses are reducing hours, and they usually do that before they lay off workers. And that's not surprising if manufacturing activity is declining. And when you see this and all of the talk about inverted yield curves and stock market volatility, you're going to see consumers get a little skittish. And that's why consumer confidence is down.
All right, Hugh, last word, and then we'll go to the phones.
Well, I can't improve upon that. And that's exactly what's happening right now is investors are taking a look at a lot of indicators that tend to lead the economy, tell us where the economy is going. Aaron mentioned one that's probably one of the most important other than the stock market and the yield curve. He mentioned the average manufacturing work week. That's a problem. It's very volatile, but consumer expectations is also a component of the Index of Leading Economic Indicators and a very useful indicator of where we might be headed. Consumer expectations. There are expectations of the future, and when that slips, it usually slips for a reason, and that's exactly what's happening.
Hugh Johnson is here. Aaron Pasitti is here. You are there. 800-348-2551 is the number. Arthur and Pauling has been waiting about 30 minutes. You're on, Arthur. Go ahead.
Yes, with Janet Shelton, the nominee for the Federal Reserve, advocating a gold standard, with Mark Mobius recently coming out and saying every investor should have his 10% of his portfolio in physical gold, and with all the editorials in the Wall Street Journal saying now is the time for gold standard, I would like to know what the gathered economists on your show opine about a gold standard or the reinstitution of it since it was stopped in August 15th of 1971.
The gold standard, so this is Aaron, the gold standard is probably one of the most prehistoric ideas in the whole economic canon. And the logic is this, is that a country can only print the amount of currency or a central bank can only issue an amount of credit equal to the amount of physical gold reserves it has on hand. So the point of the gold standard is to prevent inflation. And in the 1850s and 1860s, before the central bank, private banks would issue their own banknotes, and that was ripe with fraud because banks could just keep on issuing notes, and that leads to inflation. So the whole bimetallic, the silver-gold movement of the 1890s ultimately led to the gold standard. And if you look at the Depression as kind of the testing ground for this, countries that escaped the Great Depression the soonest were the ones who got off of the gold standard or revalued the gold standard the fastest. So the gold standard is really good at fighting inflation. Inflation hasn't been a problem in the developed world since the late 1970s. So
where it's under 2%, right?
Yeah. I mean, the Fed has been trying to get inflation above 2% since 2008. And it's been 11 years, and inflation, you know, it's gone up to 2.1, and then it comes down.
Why does it want it above 2%?
Go ahead.
What was the question?
Why does the Fed want 2% inflation?
That's a good question. I don't think there's any particular reason why they want it above 2%. I can tell you that there's a reason they don't want it at. They don't want it at 1% or less, and certainly they don't want deflation where prices are declining. And they don't want it at 4% or 5% plus. They're good, solid reasons. I'm not saying it's arbitrary, but 2% inflation has often been associated with levels of employment growth, which are positive.
Yeah.
There's nothing I've ever seen, and maybe Aaron has, that's written in stone that says there's something magical about 2%. That's what they'd like to have now. They're not there yet. I think they will get there, but they're not there.
Yeah, so that's called the Fed's inflation target. And the easiest way to think about inflation is that it can be a byproduct of economic growth. So when firms are hunting for workers, they have to bid up wages. That increases purchasing power. Firms respond by raising prices, so firms' profits go up. You don't want that to lead to a wage price spiral like we had in the early 1970s. So a lot of people ask, well, why isn't the Fed's inflation target 0%? And the answer is, if you get a recession, then you get into deflation territory.
Right.
And all you need to do is look at Japan since 1990 to understand the dangers of a deflationary spiral.
Getting back to Arthur's question, that the gold standard, as far as Aaron Pasitti goes, is not a good plan.
Not a good plan.
And Hugh Johnson as well.
Well, I would agree. Go ahead.
All due respect to the economists, the gold standard is a wonderful idea. The world, the U.S., has been under a gold standard for only 40 years off a gold standard. All the other times we have been on a gold standard, we had 80 years of virtually uninterrupted economic growth and technological advancement in the 1800s without a gold standard and without a Federal Reserve, without a central bank.
But we've also had a much more stable economy where recessions have been about half the length of the recessions prior or during the gold standard as well.
I think you ought to also look at the 1890s and take a look at what happened in places like Argentina. I think it's the record is not that good.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Hugh Johnson and Aaron Pasitti here to answer your questions. And we go to Kay in the Berkshires. Kay, you're on.
Hi. When is the best time to sell gold coins? Oh. What do I watch and what is it connected to?
Uh-huh. Well, what do you think? When the prices are high.
Yeah. Investors use gold as a hedge. And when I say investors, I mean anybody who's buying gold as an asset, usually as a hedge against inflation. And you saw gold prices spike in 2008 and 2009 when the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates to zero and expanded the money supply by $3 trillion. My biggest regret in life is that I didn't bet on gold prices to drop dramatically, knowing that the economy was
That's your biggest regret?
Yeah.
Boy, I'll tell you, it was a pretty good life.
I would have made millions if I shorted gold with my limited income then.
Money isn't everything, Aaron.
I don't know. I don't give financial advice, so I don't know when the best time to sell gold is. But my guess is, given the economic uncertainty, you probably will see increases in gold prices in the lead into and the duration of the recession.
Yeah, that's a really...
I should wait.
It's a really tough question, but and timing... Swings in gold. You're going to get a lot of swings in gold to begin with. Aaron's right that it's tied to the rate of inflation, and we all know that the rate of inflation has been unusually low, unpredictably low for quite some time now, and as a result, we haven't seen the kind of surge in the price of gold. Quite frankly, if you were optimistic that inflation was going to rise not just to the 2% target of the Federal Reserve, but 3%, 4%, you'd buy gold. So I think it depends very heavily on what you think is going to happen to inflation. I think inflation might get to 2% plus, but I don't think it's going to go to 3% or 4% anytime soon. So I'd be reluctant to buy it, except for as a safe haven, as Aaron has also suggested. And as far as the time to sell it, if you own it, which I kind of guess that you do, I would make sure you do one of two. You do both of these things, which is you make sure that it's not a big percentage of your financial assets. That's very important.
Interesting.
And the second thing is that if from a selling point of view, be patient, because at some time, and it might not be the near future, the price of the inflation will rise and the price of gold will rise. It's very hard to time that, the stock market, anything.
Kay, thanks for the call. We'll take one more here before the next break. Judy in Rochester. Judy, you're on.
Hi, thanks so much. I like your word, Mr. Pasitti, of prehistoric, because it seems to me that we have a lot of people in Washington, Trump, Ross, whatever, making prehistoric decisions in this modern day world. But that aside, like the trade war, do you think that Trump is expecting the Fed to compensate for his incompetence?
Well, there you go.
Well,
yes,
that's a really great. That's a really great question. In 1970, Arthur Burns was chairman of the Federal Reserve, and we didn't expect that he would compromise the integrity of Federal Reserve policy to get Richard Nixon elected, but he did. Our expectation today is clearly that the Chairman Powell is not going to compromise the integrity, independence of the Federal Reserve, and reduce interest rates to the extent that the president wants. That's not to say, and this is important, this is not to say that he's not going to reduce interest rates. I think that's very much on his program, that they'll cut one time or two times, but certainly not one percentage point, which would be, I think, in the minds of most observers of the Federal Reserve, unjustified or too aggressive at this point in time, or not consistent.
Is any cut justified as far as Hugh Johnson is concerned?
Absolutely. And that's what it gets to me where I was before. Whether you're looking at the yield curve, whether you're looking at economic conditions globally, the impact of trade conditions on the U.S., the slowdown in the economy, which Aaron referred to, the slowdown in 2019, slowdown in 2020, where you're looking at all of those things, putting it all together, it's probably the case that the Federal Reserve needs to reduce interest rates. They've done one time. I would say another time as an insurance move, which is the way they would put it, would certainly be justified. And if you take seriously my forecast for the start of a recession in 2020, which you shouldn't take too seriously, but nevertheless listen to it, then I would say two cuts is probably not enough. It'd probably need more. I doubt the Federal Reserve is going to do anything more than one, maybe two cuts in 2019, and we'll see what happens in 2020. So is that going to be because the president's leaning on them? I don't think so. I think it's because it's justified.
No, no. The Federal Reserve is staffed with political appointed members, but they guard their independence fiercely. So, yeah, I think that the Federal Reserve, one, raised rates too rapidly in the mid-teens, primarily to give themselves some ammunition if the economy were to hit a recession. So they raised rates so that if a recession hit, they could lower them. So, yeah, I think probably we're going to see definitely one, at most two. But if people are wondering what the Fed thinking is, listen to or read Jerome Powell's speech from the Jackson Hole Conference tomorrow.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Aaron Pasitti is here. Hugh Johnson, your calls, more of them coming up. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. The number is 800-348-2551. Hugh Johnson of Hugh Johnson Advisors here and Aaron Pasitti of Siena College answering your questions. One quick email and then we'll jump back to the phones. This one came in from Mark. And Mark writes, it's pretty much a well-known fact that President Trump is a master at not admitting the truth. That said, isn't it true that many of the positive things we see happening in the economy are actually happening because of Obama-era policies? And that's from Mark.
Looking at the macroeconomy, there's an infinite number of factors you can point to explain why it's growing or why it's shrinking. The changing course of the macroeconomy is like an oil tanker. It's very slow and it's very deliberate, and it's usually the result of changes that have been made years, if not decades prior. So, a lot of it was the momentum from the Obama-era stimulus that not only got the U.S. out of the 2008-2009 recession, but the multiplier effects that happened after that. You can point to people can point to the Trump tax cuts that explain the rise in stock prices. That certainly has something to do with it by increasing corporate earnings and projected corporate earnings. Trump's presided over the economy for, 2 years now? So to take credit for a lot of inertia seems a little bit premature.
One thing we did see right before Trump was inaugurated was the cable news networks saying, okay, we're waiting to see what happens with the markets. They're gonna dive now. Here we go. Here's the opening bell. And then it didn't. Yeah. And so, are we making too much of the presidential influence on things?
Yes, we are. First of all, I think that Aaron's right that there's a lot of the momentum, the policy decisions that were made long ago and certainly during the Obama administration have carried over to the Trump administration and have positively impacted the economy. And there's no question that the tax cuts gave a little bit of a lift to the economy. But I think that if you, for example, look at gross domestic product growth and you ask yourself, why has it been? It really has been sluggish for this entire recovery, Obama or not Obama. You look at things that are important, such as population growth, which has slowed, such as the growth in the labor force has slowed. That's because of the participation rate or the percentage of the population that's either has a job or is looking for a job has gone down. That's one thing that's not good, fewer workers. And not only do we have fewer workers, but we also have seen the productivity or the output of those workers has also come down. And you put those two things together and you're going to get a slow economy. And that has nothing to do with either Trump or Obama. So a reason why we have sluggish growth has been really frankly things that are beyond the grasp of both Trump and Obama. But I would add, importantly, that there are some things on a near-term basis that will affect the economy. And certainly, Trump's policies on trade are not helping the economy. That's showing up now in real clear numbers. Secondly, I think that the increase, which Aaron mentioned, the increase in interest rates by the Federal Reserve in 2018 probably is not helping the economy. So generally speaking, I'd say it's beyond any one president. It's like that tanker that's slow moving. I think that's true. But on a near-term basis, there are things that presidents can do, presidents and Federal Reserves can do, that will affect economic output on a near-term basis.
Let's talk about the long game for a minute. Last time you guys were on, we talked about this impending or feared trade war with China. And both of you, I think, if I remember correctly, and it's a 50-50 proposition, that you both agreed that the quote-unquote deal we have with China is lopsided toward China as far as trade policies go. In the short term, pain, at least as far as recession and bear markets, et cetera. But is the long game a different story? In other words, could it be that policies played out now had to as Trump infamously said, I'm the chosen one to take on China. But did somebody have to do it?
Short-term pain for long-term gain?
Yeah.
Not necessarily. China has pursued a policy of a very weak currency to make their exports, meaning U.S. imports, a lot more attractive. That was done through a very concerted state effort that gave U.S. consumers who were experiencing, very low wage growth access to cheap imported goods. The cost of that was a lot of U.S. manufacturing jobs moved abroad. Now, getting China to get rid of their Trump has labeled them a currency manipulator, or the Treasury Department has.
True or not true?
Every country is a currency manipulator. The U.S. has pursued a strong dollar policy at the same time China pursued a weak dollar policy. We made a very active choice not to use foreign currency reserves to weaken the value of our dollar. So every country is a currency manipulator. Listen, global investment, whether you like it or not, will shift to countries that have low-cost labor, but also a reasonably productive infrastructure. That was China from, the late 90s up until around now. Now what you're seeing is firms that can that are relocating to Southeast Asia and other countries to get higher profit margins now that wages are rising in China. So we're going to, there's always going to be a country that's the boogeyman. It was Japan in the 80s. It was, Mexico in the 90s. It's been China for the last two decades. I don't know who it's going to be next.
Canada? Blame Canada.
I think that's what Aaron says is correct. The only thing I would disagree with, and I think that's absolutely right, that you're going to see shifts. Companies are going to shift to more productive, low-wage places to do what they want to do. But I think it's also the case that that if you talk to Robert Lighthizer or others, China has been a cheater, and it's just that simple. So there's certainly some truth to the fact that China had at the edge because of both productivity as well as the cost of labor for a long, long time, and that's shifting. But it's also true that China has not played fairly, and I think that the Trump administration has been right in going after them on that. Now, the one thing you could argue with, and I think you could argue strongly with, is their way of going about it. In other words, this kind of confrontational, aggressive confrontational way of going about it. Robert Lighthizer, I have a lot of respect for him. He's very good on trade. He's very tough on trade. He's very knowledgeable. But they've been very tough, and as a result, relations have broken down, and the people that are suffering the most from the breakdown of relations between China and the U.S., the breakdown of negotiations, are people in the United States. You ask a farmer right now, what does he or she think of what's going on? And they'll say they're on the ropes, they're doing less business, and they need a lot of help. which is an effective way of saying you got to get us back to doing business with China somehow.
China knows
so this. I think there's a more gradual, more diplomatic way of getting things done. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe
haven't they been trying that for 30 years?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you've got to use a more of a, I hate to use the expression, a sledgehammer in order to get something done. And that might very well be the case, and Robert Lighthizer would certainly say that's the case.
I think the U.S. position would be
–
so, I mean, I think in combating China, a multinational approach would have been more effective than the U.S. going at it alone.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, and we go to our old buddy Larry in Columbia County. Larry, you're on.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
A couple of quick comments. You mentioned the yield curve, and you were rather specific, 12 months. I've been involved with this stuff for 50 to 60 years. The yield curve really, you got to figure 12 to 18 months in terms of its long lead as a long lead indicator. Also, this 2% inflation with the Fed, I think one of the main reasons they want a 2% inflation rate is that a low inflation does make it easier to carry debt. You don't want a high inflation. That can be highly disrupting. You don't want no inflation or negative inflation. That's very much destructive. But 2% is a mild rate, which does make debt easier to carry. Anyway, very interesting discussion. And someone commented about the leading indicators. I don't know if you remember Julie Shuskin, who developed the leading indicators. That may be before your time, but we worked together.
Oh, cool.
For years.
Well, I know Hugh wanted to comment on a couple of things you said, Larry.
Well, I didn't know Julie Shuskin, but I certainly know of him.
Julie was a sweet guy. Yeah. We had a wonderful relationship.
I think that's wonderful. On the curve, though, I think the thing to do on the curve is to recommend to everybody when they want to think about the yield curve and lead times, take a look at it's a very, very easy to access the Federal Reserve Bank of New York's yield curve work. And they publish every month not only what the curve is or what the spread is, but also the probability of a recession starting in 12 months. That's a great source to get the timing down or the importance of the yield curve and the timing. So you're right. I mean, it's an important thing to look at, and leading indicators also, as developed by Julie and I guess you or anybody else, very important to keep tracking.
Larry, thank you very much for the call. Now let's jump over to Slingerland's, and Kathy, you're on. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi. Could either of you comment on a recent report about accounting fraud with General Electric? A gentleman named Harry Makopoulos was discussing it.
It was in the news last week.
Yeah, Harry's the one that blew the whistle on Madoff.
Bernie Madoff.
Yeah. I can't comment on it. I don't know enough about it.
Yeah, I don't know anything specific.
All right, Kathy, thanks a lot for the call. Now, quickly, you guys were talking about the leading economic indicators, and you talked about the productivity of workers. How does one is this a nebulous sort of a throw a dart at a board, or can you actually quantify this very precisely?
Oh yeah.
Do you do it?
You got to assume that the numbers are right, but you quantify it simply by taking economic output as measured by gross domestic product and dividing it in some way by the size of the labor force. And we hope we have accurate numbers on both of those. And it's not quite as simple as I'm saying, but it is fairly simple math.
We're talking about people, though, right? Not robots?
Well, we're talking
robots
about people.
Robots are entering the workforce more and more.
Yes, we're talking about people.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, quickly, let's jump over to Natalie in Burt Hills. Natalie, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. We just recently had an inheritance and are looking to invest. What would your advice be with your impending recession for next June? And how severe do you think it might be and last a long time or short term, or what might that happen?
I'm not sure, but I think Aaron thinks you should give it to him. But I'm not.
I am always a safe investment.
I don't think that's a good idea. All right, gentlemen. Hugh, you go first.
Well, first of all, it's very hard to be precise. I would say, if it was me, I would say, first of all, you know, if we're at the later stages of a cycle, and a cycle consists of three parts, a stock market cycle accompanied by an economic cycle and an interest rate cycle, and if we're at the late stages, then from a timing point of view, again, very grandiose of me to say that I can get the timing anywhere near precise, that you're probably better off in waiting as far as investing in the equity markets. Now, given the grandiosity of that forecast, I would say you don't try to get that precise. So maybe you want to stage yourself in. So let's just say you want to invest 50% in stocks and 50% in bonds on a long-term basis. You might put half of what you're allocating to the stock market in now and wait on the other half simply because of where we are in the current cycle. That staging in process, or dollar cost averaging as some would call it, is a sort of a sensible way of doing it. But the one thing I would emphasize right now, if it was me, would be that I would not allocate a very high percentage of my assets to the equity markets at this stage of the cycle. Maybe later on you increase it to what would be a better rate, 60% of your portfolio in stocks, 70% of your short portfolio in stocks. Remember, the returns from stocks are going to be significantly better than bonds. But for now, you might want to have a very modest allocation to stocks and stage it in.
All right. Aaron, no, you good? Let's jump over quickly to James and Hudson. James, you have about a minute here.
Okay. I'm going to try to be quick. I'm usually succinct.
Good.
I think the real problem is there's been no rise in real wages where the cost of living keeps going up. And that's been in like the last like two decades.
Yeah, I mean, you can even go ahead, James.
Go ahead,
Aaron.
No, I was going to say no. I think you're absolutely right that since you know, the late 1970s, real wages have more or less been flat. You know, depending on which measure of wages and which, you know, deflator you use, but the general story is there is that, you know, real wages, which constitute the main indicator of the standard of living for, you know, most middle class and upper middle class families, has been relatively stagnant, with the few exceptions of the late 1990s, and the last few years we've seen a rising real wages just because inflation has been so low.
All right, Hugh, you get last word, 20 seconds.
Well, I can't improve on that either. Aaron's absolutely right. And if you know, that's part at the heart of one of the things that Aaron talked about before that he works on, which is income inequality, which is a very big part of the current landscape. We've hit it from a couple of points of view. One is that flat real wages for most people, and at the same time, lots of people getting big gains in the stock market. But that's the upper. That's, as you mentioned, the numbers 1%, 90%, 50%. Those are the folks that own the stocks, and those are the people that become very wealthy, and that their real incomes have been
substantial.
It is the source of a lot of income inequality.
Well, thank you both for being here today. Support comes from Agricultural Stewardship Association, presenting Landscapes for Land's Sake art exhibit October 12th through 14th in Washington County. Opening reception October 12th, noon to 5 p.m. to benefit farmland protection. agstewardship.org. Whitney's Farm Market at Country Gardens, Cheshire, featuring a Boar's Head Deli with daily specials, bakery, homemade fudge, lobster rolls, and more, plus fresh seasonal produce, whitneysfarm.com. And the Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate liberal arts theater program with concentrations in design, technology, theater studies, and performance, newpaltz.edu/theater. Thanks once again to Hugh Johnson and Aaron Pasitti for joining us. Thank you. Great calls today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Kayleen White did a superb job on the phone answering. Jim Lavoulis is our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. Oh, the folks from CIA are here. We talk beer. Oh, well, mark my calendar. Stand by for the Capital Connection.